The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to go walking with a dynamic young organization called Girl Trek. And if you haven't heard about them, their co-founder and CEO, Morgan Dixon, is only too happy to tell you what they do.
Girl Trek is now the largest health organization serving Black women and girls. Our mission is to rally 1 million Black women to walk outside their front doors and take to the streets of their neighborhoods for total healing, to inspire their daughters, and to reclaim space in the 50 highest need communities in America.
And then you will hear from Susan Wolf Dickhoff, a partner at the Bridgebrand Group, who recently co-authored an article in the Stanford Social Innovation Review titled, When Philanthropy Meets Advocacy. She says that philanthropists can really have an impact on the issues they care about through advocacy.
They say things like, we don't do advocacy. Our family members, our board, our staff, they don't want us to get political. We're worried about losing our charitable status if we engage. And these are really scripts from almost a bygone era at this point. Those fears are real, but there are really, really important ways that philanthropists can engage in advocacy that overcomes some of those fears to address the issues that they care most about.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, July 8th. Charities appear to be chasing millennial donors by showering them with mail and email communications, according to a new study. People under age 35 get about 27 emails and mailers from nonprofits per week, far more than the 15 older people receive. More than a quarter donors surveyed are comfortable making donations of $500 or more online, but the overall donor preference begins to shift to offline giving at about the $300 level, according to a recent survey by Community Brands. And finally, Hawaii lawmakers passed a bill that bans the sale of sunscreens that have chemicals believed to damage coral reefs. The ban is scheduled to take effect on January 1, 2021. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Morgan Dixon of Girl Trek right after this.
Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile? I consider it to have been a real accomplishment to have gotten my next guest to come in today to sit down with me for an interview. Because, more often than not, you'll find her walking. Walking alone, walking with a group of friends, and now walking with nearly 150,000 other Black women in an extraordinary grassroots movement known as Girl Trek. She is Morgan Dixon, the co-founder and CEO of Girl Trek. Good evening, Morgan, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thank you for having me.
Share with us, Morgan, the mission of Girl Trek.
Girl Trek is now the largest health organization serving Black women and girls. Our mission is to rally 1 million Black women to walk outside their front doors and take to the streets of their neighborhoods for total healing, to inspire their daughters, and to reclaim space in the 50 highest need communities in America.
How did this idea get started, Morgan? I know it was just you and your friend Vanessa. What in the world happened that ultimately has led to this?
A whole lifetime, Denver. I'm sure your viewers or your listeners are not at all interested in. How did this all start? You know, it's interesting. You know, in the world of social innovation, we get asked this question a lot. And unlike many of my colleagues, there was never an aha moment. And there was never a business plan. And there were very few pitches. Vanessa Garrison is the co-founder of Girl Trek. She was my friend in college. And we are literally still every day just trying to save our own lives. And so we, you know, both of us were the first in our families to complete a 4-year college education. We, you know, our second, third year in college, we're making more money than either of our parents had made in their lifetime. We were exposed to resources and all sorts of things that were powerful, but also dangerously slippery. And just started to notice the kind of injustices in our own lives and the choices we had to make. And everything started to feel like kind of, as we say with each other, kind of a setup for a takedown. We were like, what is this? What's happening here? And, you know, Vanessa looked kind of at her family, and the life expectancy in her family was in the early 60s. She had lost a grandmother, many aunts, just from preventable diseases. And she talked to me about it a lot. And I was a classroom teacher. And I heard the statistic that half of the girls in my classroom at that time were going to get diabetes. And for me, like, I was in Teach for America. There's nothing I could teach that day or that week or that month that seemed to matter, knowing that statistic, that half of them were going to get diabetes. So we started trying a bunch of things. And then we started trying to save our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we started holding each other accountable as friends. That's when we started shooting for ambitious goals. I'd never done backpacking before. I did this 50-mile backpacking trip because why not? And she had never run before. She did the Chicago Half Marathon because that was a huge deal for her. And in order to do both of those things, we had to start somewhere. So we started walking together, talking together, holding each other accountable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the health of Black women in America today, and particularly as it relates to preventable disease. What do those numbers look like?
Thank you for asking the question. I hesitate to jump right into the numbers. Let me tell you the numbers, and then maybe we can unpack them.
Yeah.
So right now, today, 137 Black women will die from preventable heart disease. And that's every 11 minutes. And when we do trainings, we do this beautiful Tibetan chime every 11 minutes because it's startling how quickly that is.
Mm.
So in a 3-hour session, that's like 17 women have passed. And that's hard. That number is abstract and it's hard to understand. But for me, you know, I travel so much, I always imagine all of the planes that I travel on. That's like a plane filled with Black women crashing to the ground every day. And in context, that's only, it's startling when you think about that. But in context, what we know is that Black women are dying faster and at higher rates than any other group of people in America from preventable obesity-related diseases. So half of Black women, 53% of Black women are obese. And 82% of us are over a healthy weight or overweight.
Mm-hmm.
So one might think that this is an obesity issue, and that would be wrong.
Right.
Yeah, that would be wrong. Obesity is an issue because it leads to early death, for sure. But it's not the root cause.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many root causes of the obesity crisis in America at large. One, we work way too much. Mm-hmm. We sit way too much. We eat food that has been produced for profit, not for our bodies. There are many root causes. The statistic that stands out to me as the leading root cause for me, my family, and the women I love is that 2/3 of Black women engage in little to no leisure time physical activity, so no exercise. So if you have over 70% of Black women who are engaging in no exercise, that to me is an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm talking at trainings, I always put the statistic on the board and ask. And, you know, the constant refrain is, what leisure time? Like, who has leisure time? Like that. And it's, you know, it's, we always laugh about it, but it actually is so true that if, in fact, Black women have been valued for their labor in this country for 400 years,
yeah,
it is true. And if every time you go to the post office or a Whole Foods or you get on a city bus and you see a Black woman who is in service of others, at what cost is the question? And so for me, it's really interesting to think about reclaiming time,
mm-hmm,
as a revolution, as a radical act, right? And so our movement is less about walking, although walking is the most powerful thing you can do, and we can talk about that later. Our movement is much more about reclaiming at least 30 minutes a day for self-care. And if we can encourage, and if we can mobilize, and if we can rally 1 million Black women, mothers, aunts, grandmothers, daughters, students, activists, artists to do that every single day, we believe that we're onto something, slowing down, taking 30 minutes of to ourselves, and in that 30 minutes, doing something that is radically powerful and transformational for the health crisis at large.
Yeah, and I've noticed often you don't use the word self-care, but sometimes you use survival because you believe it resonates better. Why would that be the case?
Well, I think self-care can feel vapid. I think it can feel like bubble baths and smelling salts.
A little frivolous.
It can. But, you know, Audre Lorde said that, you know, self-preservation is an act of political warfare. And I believe that. I believe that when you think about the world in terms of labor, when you think about the world in terms of capital, if you think about the people who are providing the labor, taking time to care for their bodies and demand kind of what they need to be healthy, whole, and sustained, that feels radical. That doesn't feel like bubble baths.
Yeah, right. Now, I suspect there are probably no rules to be part of Girl Trek, but there are certainly guidelines. How much, how often do you encourage these women to walk?
That's where you would be wrong. There are tons of rules on Girl Trek. Yeah, no. All right. Let me just tell you, when you're starting the health movement and you're getting a million black women to walk, no. We actually studied pickup basketball and we said pickup basketball is like the hidden public health gym.
Yeah.
Like people all across the country do it every Saturday morning. How can we create these kind of game rules that everyone can understand? So we have something called the Trek Code. So if you see Girl Trekkers across the country anytime, we're always wearing bright superhero blue, and we do that so that people can see our service, because we want you, Denver, to see us in Central Park or in parks all across the country. But our number one rule is we never leave a sister behind. Mm-hmm. It's our number one rule because everyone's walking at their own pace. What we ask women to do is to walk 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and to, if you don't meet that goal, to at least walk on Saturday mornings. The reason why we chose kind of 30 minutes, 5 days a week is because we know that if a woman does that, that she decreases her chances, her risks of getting certain preventable diseases by nearly half. So diabetes, stroke, heart disease, even Alzheimer's, dementia, are all halved by physical activity, 30 minutes of physical activity by day. Your risk of getting those diseases are cut down by half. And that, for us, feels powerful and necessary and a beautiful thing. So that's what we're doing.
And just hearing you, too, walking is really underestimated, isn't it, as a core activity? We kind of just sort of take it for granted, but it seems that it makes a profound difference.
You know, it's interesting that the 18th U.S. Surgeon General is on our board of directors, and she started a walking campaign, and everyone was like, really? Is that kind of how you want to spend your capital? And she said, listen, if every doctor in the country could prescribe one thing, I would tell them to prescribe walking, because it is the single most powerful thing anyone can do to improve health. So absolutely, it's underestimated.
Yeah, yeah. And there's something very powerful about propelling yourself forward.
Yeah, you know, Psychology Today did this story on Girl Trek, and you know, everyone knows that Girl Trek is mobilizing a million black women to walk, and particularly in the highest need communities in America. And we know that that is powerful for the health crisis disproportionately facing black women. But we also know that it's powerful for agency and advocacy, right? And so Psychology Today said, you know, what is it about Girl Trek? When women and Girl Trek start walking together, they start changing things. And why is that? And the story concluded that there's something powerful about the rhythm of walking on the same pace with someone else. That when you walk, you can talk because you're walking at a pace that is rigorous, but also comfortable enough for talking. When you walk, you are assessing the needs of your neighborhood. And when you walk, you have a sense of agency and forward momentum so that you are in a space of hope. And that feels just incredibly smart to have a million black women doing that together.
It sure does. How do you get started in a community or a city? I mean, how did you get started, Morgan, in Philadelphia or Chicago or Seattle?
Yeah, it's the best part about Girl Trek is that Girl Trek starts wherever there is a motivated woman. And so we say there is a Harriet in every neighborhood in America, in reference to Harriet Tubman. You don't have to wait for anyone for Girl Trek. We don't have formal chapters. Just speaking about innovation, we had formal chapters at one point. We had city captains and neighborhood captains. We had certified this and certified that and super, super codified like hierarchy. And it reminded me of growing up in the church, because that's where I got my sense of leadership from. And it was a disaster. It was a disaster. It was great to get us to about 30,000 members. And then after 30,000, it just became like incredibly complicated. And so we looked and studied the civil rights movement. We looked and studied powerful movements and powerful nonprofits, even like, Alcoholics Anonymous mm-hmm. and the NRA. And we studied, just incredible, powerful movements and how they happened. And in the civil rights movement, the thing that stuck out most is that there were clear outcomes that everyone was going for, which ours is to inspire a million people to start walking. There were rules that, and core values that were super clear to everyone, and we have those. And then it was, in the words of Ella Baker, strong people don't need strong leaders. Give them light and they will find the way. Mm-hmm. It was identifying these leaders across the country who were ordinary women who were leaders of self. And if they could be leaders of self, they could then rally their own friends and family to act in service of self. So that is how Girl Trek works across the country. So in practical sense, a woman hears about Girl Trek, perhaps on your show today, and she goes to Girl Trek. She takes the pledge, which is to say that I will walk at least 5 days a week, 30 minutes a day, especially and always on Saturday that we call Superhero Saturdays. Mm-hmm. And after she takes the pledge, she laces up her sneakers, she opens her front door, and she goes for her first walk. Well, that can get boring after walk three or four, for sure, particularly if you're walking in neighborhoods that, are developments that are not incredibly walkable or not incredibly safe or beautiful. And so Girl Trek makes it our mission to inspire this woman to keep walking until she achieves habit formation, mm-hmm. which for us is walking at least 3 months, regularly, yep. daily. And so we produce something called Harriet's Handbook, which is 1,000 walks to save your own life. And we incentivize every time you meet benchmarks so that a woman herself can just pick up this handbook. She can walk. She can create a new habit for saving her life. And in doing so, she inspires other women to do it. Now, what inevitably happens is that a woman gets really, really excited. She experiences success, right in the first couple of weeks. She gets so excited that she rallies her whole church and they mm-hmm. all start walking together, or her whole sorority or her whole neighborhood. And so that's what's happening in places like Henderson, North Carolina, with Avonda and her entire church, or Cynthia in the entire city of Jackson, Mississippi. One woman got the entire city activated. And so that's happening all across the country.
Wonderful champions. Let's yep. talk a little bit about Harriet, because if there is a patron saint of this movement, it would be Harriet Tubman. Tell us a little bit about her life and why she's such an inspiration to you and really everyone who knows about her.
Well, she's the baddest freedom fighter America's ever seen.
There you go.
Yeah, the end. The end. Harriet Tubman is, in all seriousness, just a giant in American history. She's just a giant. She incorporates and embodied all of American values. And the reason we celebrate her life is because not only did she live to be 92 years old, but she did it with just the most swagger and style mm-hmm. and kind of courage. Harriet Tubman, for those who are listening who may not remember, I think we probably all learned about her in, the fifth or sixth grade.
Right.
But that was a long time ago, so let me give you a refresher. Harriet Tubman was an enslaved African-American woman. She lived on the eastern shore of Maryland. She walked herself to freedom across the Mason-Dixon line. She walked north. And then she came back several times for her friends and her family members. And then she created a network of allies to help her transport hundreds of people to freedom. And then after doing that, she became just an American hero. She worked as a spy for the Union Army. She mm-hmm. was the first woman to lead a military operation in America. And she just did incredible things throughout her entire life. And so for us and for Girl Trek, it is just incredibly powerful to think about what we now call the Tubman Doctrine. And that doctrine includes kind of four steps. One, save yourself first. And that is hard to even say.
Yeah.
Right? I think for better or worse, our country is founded in service to others. I think particularly in African-American culture, and particularly with women, service to others over service to yourself is just ingrained from birth. And so saying that self-care is a revolutionary act and asking women to save themselves first feels hard. And so looking to Harriet Tubman as an example of that and what comes of that is a really powerful example. So when we ask women to do that, not unlike put your own kind of mask on first in an airplane.
Right.
I don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah. That's a good analogy.
Yeah. Not unlike that. Asking women to save themselves first, which means if your sister, if the women at your church, if no one else wants to walk with you, to walk alone.
Mm-hmm.
When you find out how to make time for yourself every day, then come back for others, and then rally women and allies who will support you. And then the last thing we learned from Harriet Tubman is to live joyfully after you've done that. And so, you know, that, particularly in America now, this notion of slowing down in order to serve others, of slowing down and caring for oneself in order to practice joy and bring kind of light into the world, is a really kind of different concept for me personally.
Yeah.
For me personally. And it's a concept that I needed personally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know you celebrate Harriet Tubman Day, don't you?
We do.
On March 10th.
March 10th, every year. Mm-hmm. Every year we had 15,000 women. We had women join us on the National Mall on the centennial of her passing, which was in 2013. Had no intention of celebrating it every year. There was an outcry from the streets the next year. And so every single year we do this just colossal celebration of Harriet Tubman. And then this 3 months ago, we actually walked in her actual footsteps. Me and the national staff, or 10 women, walked 100 miles along the actual Underground Railroad from where she began, and, you know, northbound into Delaware.
Let's turn away from the women for a moment to the community.
Okay.
And what is the impact of a few, then a group, then ultimately a multitude of women walking through a community on that very community?
Ah, Denver, everything changes. And I know that I've seen it happen, and I can't wait for it to happen everywhere. I'm so excited about the potential for Girl Trek. So what happens when a woman starts walking is, first of all, she energizes herself, and she's a better citizen. She's an activated citizen. And our government, our healthcare systems, everyone is trying to figure out what we are now calling this kind of inspiration gap. How do you make someone spirited? How do you make someone an active citizen again when they are immobilized by debt and fear and trauma and the news and all sorts of things that keep us glued to our couches in depression and sadness and overwhelm? And so the first thing that I just don't want to dismiss is that you have one active citizen, and that in and of itself is powerful. Once you get one woman active, what we have found is that there's this kind of cascade of great decision making that happens. You know what I mean? Because you go out, you take a 4 mile walk, you burn, you know, 350 calories. The last thing you want to do is eat a bag of Doritos after that.
Yeah.
You're like, listen, I worked so hard to burn those calories.
I'm not giving it away.
Right. So she starts to eat better. She, when you walk, you have time to think, so you can prioritize your life in different ways. What starts to happen is she becomes a healthy role model for her family and for her friends, and other people want some of that. They want some of that peace of mind. They want some of that joy. They want some of that radiance. And so other women start walking with her.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes her daughter starts walking with her. Sometimes her mother starts walking with her. And in many cases, I could show you so many pictures of 3 and 4 generations of women walking together.
That's very sweet.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what happens when a group of women start walking is they start to reclaim space in neighborhoods. So where it may not have felt safe to walk through the south side of Chicago at 6 a.m. before work, when you have a group of 20 women walking on the south side of Chicago before work, it actually changes the dynamic because these are our aunts, our mothers, our sisters, our cousins, and our daughters who are walking. And say what you will about any of my communities, it's that we have a code. We have a code of respect and honor. And when women and mothers are walking, that code is activated. And so that matters. And then last but not least, when you have whole communities of walking, you have a critical mass, and you can do things like change policy, improve built environment. You can plant gardens. We do walking school buses. We do free programming in the parks. Women become certified to lead mental health walk and talks. There's so many beautiful things that are down the pipeline once women start walking.
Yeah, I was just thinking of mental health when you were talking about it, because when women walk together, they talk together. So not only are they trying to impact the community and benefit it, it must be good for their own mental health to sort of share stories and realize that there's a sisterhood.
Yeah. Well, listen, loneliness is deadlier than cigarette smoking. I don't know if you've read all these studies. And loneliness is an epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And
at
growing.
At least in our country. And so what has started to happen is that women are meeting some of their best friends through Girl Trek, because there's a kind of a like-minded and a spiritual alignment around wanting to do better. We ask women to publish their walks, you know, of the 100 walks you commit to do in the beginning. We ask women to publish at least 10 of them, and we ask them to do that in order to be a lifeline to others. Because if you were sitting on your couch or you were at work and you were overwhelmed, what you need more than anything is to be seen and to be heard and to be acknowledged. And so there is an army of women out there waiting to be your friends and waiting to be your ears and waiting to kind of bear witness to your life. And so Girl Trek has become a powerful mental health intervention. What that means, though, is that we then need to be prepared for that. So we are training women all across the country to be mental health first aid responders. So they are walking and they are talking, but they are also prepared to kind of intervene just like you would if you were doing first aid, to do first aid for mental health emergencies.
Let's talk about the spiritual nature of what you do and yourself. I was really taken at your TED Talk in Vancouver that you started it with a prayer, which I found to be quite refreshing and quite unusual for a TED Talk. Tell us a little bit, Morgan, about your own spiritual journey and how it informs the work you do at Girl Trek.
Listen, my spiritual journey is complicated, to say the least. I grew up in the church. My mm-hmm. mother is a missionary in the church. When I went to college, I most definitely did not go to church and started to explore as much spiritual teaching and knowledge as I could, and was just very taken by people like Pema Chodron and Thich Nhat Hanh, who talked about this notion of walking meditations, of putting feet to your prayers, of marrying kind of action activism with spirituality and faith. And for me, that is the best kind of religion, anything that compels you to act in the service of the greater good. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we started our TED Talk by, I always ask God to just guide my words and guide my feet. Because I was taught to do that, and because it's a really important part of my culture, and it's because it's my core belief. But I believe, in terms of Girl Trek, we have spiritual warriors, and then we have just outright gangsta hustlers out there. So I'm just saying, like, all are welcome, and we need all in the movement for sure. I believe that, especially now, that faith, and what I mean by faith, is this ability to dream and hope and envision a world that is just dynamic and beautiful and loving, and to move in the direction of that without having further evidence that it is possible is necessary. And I think that's what social innovators do. Mm-hmm. I think there's just a different language for it. And so I just consider myself a translator often to bring as many people along.
Yeah. I mean, I find it to be a very interesting branding challenge in some ways because, again, you're looking to create a movement, which I think you've identified as 1 million women. You're at 150,000, so you're about a seventh of the way there. But sometimes when you're trying to create one of these things, to have it all inclusive and not have some people say, well, that's for them over here or this group over here, really does become a branding challenge. How do you look at that, and how are you thinking about scaling it the other six-sevenths of the way to hit that million mark?
So we always knew it would be hardest to get 100,000 people to join.
Yeah, always
It's like did you see the TED Talk, How a Movement Gets Started? Mm-hmm. You have the lone nut and then the second follower.
I did.
So our first 100,000 are, you know, essentially our second followers all across.
You're the lone nut, right?
We're the lone nut. They're the second followers. And thank God we now have a movement.
You do.
So the good news is that when I wear my Girl Trek shirt around Manhattan, now everyone notices and recognizes it. So now it's a matter, we have the attention of the world. It's a matter of making the case. And that to me feels infinitely easier than knocking on doors and being in church basements to get the first 100,000. Mm-hmm. So we're super excited to have some really powerful media partners. We've partnered with Essence Magazine. We've partnered with BET Her. We've partnered with, TheRoot.com. All of these just powerful kind of new media and traditional media partners to start to get the message out. We've also started to partner institutionally with Black sororities, with the faith-based community in churches. We are talking to kind of first ladies of churches across the country. We're challenging all of them to see who the healthiest first lady in the country is. That has been really powerful. And so we are really excited about the growth and the scale, and have no doubt that we'll reach 1 million. Mm-hmm. It seems much easier than kind of the one-on-one recruitment that we've done to get to 100,000. So we're excited about that. You asked another question. What was it?
Branding, maybe?
Yeah. Listen, truth doesn't have to be parsed. I mean, I just really feel like this is a crisis of epic proportion. And if people and anyone who cares deeply about humanity understands that, And so when I say that we are rallying 1 million black women to walk to save their lives, if that offends you, then this is not for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you are inspired by that, whether you are black, white, male, or female, then this is a community for you, and we need you, quite frankly. And so some of our allies, you know, there's a man named, do you know David Bornstein, the writer in the New York Times?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Right. I have had Tina Rosenberg on the show with Solutions Journalism.
Oh, yeah. I love Solutions Journalism and Tina and David. Mm-hmm. So David has been one of our greatest allies, and you would never think that. A movement of a million black women. Well, we used to always say this crisis should be on the cover of every newspaper in America.
Absolutely.
And so when David did the New York Times feature on us, I could no longer say that. I was like, okay.
All right.
You called
on
my
more
bluff.
Newspapers in America.
So, you know, there is a role. I mean, when we walked 100 miles in the Underground Railroad, there was a young white photographer, female or woman photographer, who followed us every single step and photographed the journey. Mm. She laid in swamps in the middle of a nor'easter and took the photos. That's the kind of allyship I'm talking about. And so if you understand that our goal is to speak directly to black women, to rally black women, because if we do that, we can create a proof point and a model for all of America and potentially the globe for social change, then this is for you. And that doesn't feel like a branding issue. It just feels honest.
Yeah, you're onto something big. And, you know, talking about that 100-mile trek, it got me to thinking about some of the adventures that you orchestrate, like to the Rocky Mountains and things. Tell us about a couple of those.
Listen, oh, you just gave me a great memory. We do something called the Summer Trek Series, where we partner with the National Park Service. We go to some of the most beautiful places on the planet. And our country is just so stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I just encourage anyone listening today to just make time this summer to see a part of the country you haven't seen before. It's just a stunning part. So we were going into Yosemite Valley, and there was two minivans. We try not to take large groups because, just like my church home, you know, the outdoors is a sanctuary for many. And so we were super respectful. It's a part of our core values. So we took a group of women. Most of them were older women from a church. And as soon as we came into the park, and have you ever been to Yosemite?
Yeah, sure.
Oh. Yeah. And so, you know, the valley is just stunning. And immediately there are just tears and hands raised and look at God, right? And, and you know, the women from both Sacramento and Oakland said, how is it possible? Some of them were tears from just the sheer beauty. Some of them were tears of regret. How is it possible that I've lived my entire life just a few hours away from this majesty and I've never seen it?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, whatever trips Girl Trek plans, we're doing the Rocky Mountains here in just a few weeks, whatever we do, it's just to spark that feeling that life is to be lived, that we are here not walking just to drop pounds, but to live our healthiest and our most fulfilled lives, and you deserve it and you're worth it. So that, to me, feels like a powerful, if you want to call it a brand, but I call it just a personal mission.
Yeah. Sounds like one too. So let me get you out on this, Morgan. Boy, Girl Trek has no shortage of wonderful and inspirational stories of women who have really been part of this movement. Why don't you share one or two of those with us?
So I'm trying to think of the best one to share with you today. So there is, I'll share one that's just fresh on my mind. So we are now doing something called the Road to Selma. I don't know if you've been following.
I have.
Yeah. So we are next summer, we are convening a few thousand women to become certified Girl Trek activists and organizers in their communities. And we're doing that on hallowed ground in Selma, Alabama. Well, in order to prepare the women for this experience, we are doing a national tour and we're going to 50 cities. So in the last 3 days, I've been in three different cities. I've been in Detroit, I've been in Jackson, Mississippi, and I've been in New Orleans. And this will continue until next summer. In Jackson, Mississippi, I sat in an old kind of agricultural museum, and there were hundreds of women there, and they were all wearing their blue shirts, and we call it an old school teaching and wellness revival. And so, like, all these hundreds of women are coming to get certified to be Girl Trek organizers. And we do something called a self-care audit. And we ask women to step forward or step back according to whether, you know, what we say occurs to them, like, did you get 6 hours of sleep last night, that kind of thing. And before we started, I said, make sure that you're standing in a place where you can move, you know. And there was one young lady who stood not in the front of the line, but way in front of everyone. Mm-hmm. And she just stood there and she just took up her space. And And I happen to know that young lady's story. And I mean, I think she's about 20 years old.
Okay.
And she struggles. She struggles with an autoimmune disease. And because of it, has lost her hair, has lost pigmentation in her skin, has battled with her own personal weight and health and also in mental health. And for her to have the confidence to just literally claim her own space came from something. And I think I know where it came from. About 4 years ago, it was her mother, her name is Cynthia, who came to a Girl Trek training in the Rocky Mountains and professed that she was not able to be an organizer because she didn't know how to talk to people. She was super shy. And Cynthia went on to try and organize in Jackson, Mississippi and not be successful the first, you know, probably 4 or 5 months and wanted to give up. And we said, well, you know what? You just keep walking. Because you have daughters, because you're a member of your church, you just keep walking. Well, she did that and she walked rain or shine and she started to experience weight loss, dramatic weight loss. She mood elevation and just she started to experience the health benefits of a new daily habit like walking. And everyone started to notice. And so before long, of course, other people started walking with her. Fast forward a year later, she was the most successful organizer in the country. She had churches and schools and neighborhoods all across Jackson, Mississippi. To this day, Jackson, Mississippi has thousands of Girl Trek walkers. Any given park on any given Saturday, you will see Superhero Blue. And it's all because of Cynthia. She's been on the news talking. She's still shy, which makes her incredibly endearing and wonderful, but she pushes through. All of that success and the greatest success that she's had was with her daughter just 2 days ago. With her daughter's confidence, with her daughter's wherewithal, and commitment to her own personal kind of journey. And for me, it was just incredibly moving. Incredibly moving.
Well, it's moving to all of us. What a wonderful story. Well, Morgan Dixon, the co-founder and CEO of Girl Trek, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For people who want to learn more about Girl Trek or perhaps take those first steps that will help change their life, what is your website and what information do you have on it?
Please follow us on social media at Girl Trek, GIRLTREK, across all social media. And then please join us and take the pledge at girltrek.org.
Well, thanks, Morgan. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Denver, you're wonderful.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Through Grameen America's groundbreaking microfinance model, tens of thousands of low-income women in New York are getting the financial capital they need to build small businesses and climb out of poverty. Join the movement. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
In a given year, when $60 billion is given to foundations, only about $2.5 billion, or just 4%, goes towards advocacy work. But with advocacy campaigns having had a track record of success, from ending apartheid in South Africa to LGBT rights, the question becomes, why isn't more of this happening? This is among the items examined in a recent article in the Stanford Social Innovation Review titled, When Philanthropy Meets Advocacy. And it's a pleasure to have with us its co-author, Susan Wolf Ditkoff, who is a partner at the Bridge Grant Group and the co-head of their philanthropy practice. Good evening, Susan, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's begin with the question I just posed. Knowing the impact that advocacy campaigns have had in the past, why aren't more donors doing it?
You know, many philanthropists focus on programs and program outcomes. They focus on education, after-school programs, and they want to see the numbers of people who are affected directly by the money that they give. Politically active philanthropists really remain the exception, not the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And many people we meet with really want to stay above the political fray, even on issues they care about passionately. So they say things like, we don't do advocacy. Our family members, our board, our staff, they don't want us to get political. We're worried about losing our charitable status if we engage. And these are really scripts from almost a bygone era at this point. Those fears are real, but they're really, really important ways that philanthropists can engage in advocacy that overcomes some of those fears to address the issues that they care most about.
Let me ask you this, Susan. Does the public want to see this? I mean, do they want the charitable sector to play a larger role with the federal government to solve societal problems, or do they prefer the separation?
I think it's a mix. I think that in 2016, the independent sector did a poll that found that nearly 80% of voters support a bigger role for the charitable sector, working with the federal government to produce better solutions to problems. It's also true that those voters are more likely, 70% of them are more likely to back a presidential candidate who supports the charitable sector's involvement in government and policymaking. At the same time, it is true that philanthropy is a fundamentally undemocratic institution, mm-hmm. and it always has been. It's a public expression of private values. And so I think the public looks at some of the philanthropic successes like LGBTQ rights, like public libraries, and they're excited about those. But there also is awareness of the role, again, of that public, you know, of the public power and the public impact of private values.
Right. Well, in your article, When Philanthropy Meets Advocacy, you state that if philanthropists are going to activate advocacy efforts, they're going to have to think through five strategic questions. So let's run through those, starting with the most basic and arguably the most important, and that is, do you know the rules of engagement? So what are some of those rules, Susan?
One question that we get from a lot of philanthropists is, what am I even allowed to do?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much fear and lack of knowledge about what's possible that people want to stay very far away from crossing legal lines and putting their 501c3 or philanthropic status into jeopardy. So, for example, there are many things you can't do. You can't necessarily, with a 501c3 designation, you can't donate money to a political candidate in an active political campaign without a bunch of restrictions, or to a ballot initiative without restrictions and disclosures and that sort of thing. But there are so many important pieces of advocacy that are beyond those specific ballot initiatives or candidates. So, for example, conducting research to influence policy debate is completely inbounds.
Mm-hmm.
Mobilizing constituencies to advocate for things, that is inbounds. Pursuing changes through legal strategies, through H elections or other parts of the code, which are so arcane that you really need legal advice to pursue them, but they are all inbounds. And I think when people look to see what kinds of things they can do, they're quite surprised, and there's a lot more flexibility that people can exercise. I think the other thing that foundations can do quite powerfully and philanthropists can do is provide general operating support to organizations. And that is another way to essentially, which is not program specific or campaign specific. That's another way to engage.
Yeah, I would agree. So many organizations are not even close to the line, although they think they might be. The second thing is, who is the opposition? And there are times when a group can't imagine that there could be any opposition to what they want to do, but often they're wrong. And you cite a wonderful example of this with Autism Speaks. What happened in their case?
It's a great question. And my co-author, Patrick Guerrero of Civitas, gives a metaphor of a set of well-intentioned, good-hearted people, smart, thoughtful, who are on a football field, and they can't, for whatever reason, get past the 20-yard line. They can't. They're not scoring touchdowns. They can't get into the red zone. They don't know why. And there's just this invisible force that keeps them out. And it's a powerful metaphor because a lot of folks, and you know, myself included, before I started deeply engaging in this, you know, you think you have a selfless, public-spirited cause, and that's fantastic. And why wouldn't anyone support, for example, autistic children who have autism, live with autism in families? And it turns out that for pretty much every cause, there is a counter cause,
mm-hmm.
And there are forces that are keeping that reality in place. There are intentional forces, incentives, organizations, money that is on the other side of what might seem like an obvious or selfless issue. I mean, Autism Speaks was a very interesting example because they had been working in North Carolina to increase the coverage that health plans were giving to a particularly effective treatment for autism called ABA, which is Applied Behavioral Analysis. And what's interesting is that, you know, there's research that shows that it should have broad bipartisan support because not only did it help these kids, but it actually had a variety of financial benefits
mm-hmm.
as well. and they were really facing a lot of resistance, and they weren't quite sure why. And it turned out that the people who were resisting the legislation, essentially, they'd been battling with insurance companies all over the country, but they had not completely understood what was happening there. So they actually dug into publicly available lobbying data, disclosure reports, that sort of thing, and found that a lot of money was being spent on lobbying the state government against coverage for these services. And so what's interesting is that Liz, who is the who's their executive, Liz Feld, she was the president at the time, she really kind of took a step back and said, wait a minute, how are these people that we've been battling with, how do we really change the conversation? And so what they did was they had a public campaign, not only a statewide poll that said more than 80% of voters were actually supportive of the insurance reform, but they also had a messaging campaign highlighting the fiscally conservative reasons for the Republican-controlled legislature to support the bill. And so there were other things. There were data. There was data. There were advertisements. It was both head and heart. And so it was really a complicated set of negotiations, but they made a tremendous amount of progress by really thinking through who was the opposition, who were the natural supporters, and how did they need to level the playing field in a different way to achieve their goals.
Well, it's always out there whether you see it or not, so that's a great recommendation. The third question you ask is, have you converted strategy to an opportunity map? Now, walk us through that one, Susan.
It's a really interesting question of where are there places where there might be natural allies or natural processes that are already happening that you can plug into. And here's what I mean by that. A number of philanthropists want to go for white space. They want to go where others aren't, and they want their money to make a difference, and they'd like to, you know, begin getting some momentum around an issue they care about. And that is important. For sure, there are gaps that philanthropy can fill. But it's also true that if you go to white space, by definition, what you're not doing is supporting things that have some momentum. And so,
absolutely,
part of the question, right?
White space can be very lonely.
It can, right? There's got to be a Yogi Berra saying about this. But yes, exactly. If you're in white space, you're on your own. So I do think that there's a question of pulling back and saying, where are the opportunities? Here is my long-term goal, or even my medium-term goal. Here's a winnable milestone that I'm looking to see. And in the Trust for Public Lands case, they were saying, we want a park within 10-minute walk of every person, every city, every town across America. And so as they began to sort of think about their campaign, part of their question was, well, what's it going to take to do that? And it turned out that there were 100 million Americans, once they did their mapping, that lacked this access, which is so important. It's important psychologically. It's important for the environment. It's important for children, older adults who need places to convene. So there's a people aspect to it, not just an environmental aspect. It's a really broad set of benefits that you get with that they were identifying. But at the same time, they asked the question, well, how can we do this? There are 100 million people. How do we think about this? And what their opportunity map revealed was that there was really an opportunity to engage with the nation's mayors through, in this instance, the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And by advocating by identifying and working with a core group of mayors to kind of answer the question of what would this look like in your city over the next decade, they really realized that they could build momentum and convert even more mayors in new cities. So when they launched in October of 2017, they and their partner organizations had a parks advocacy campaign, which had already enlisted bipartisan mayors. It was more than 125 mayors. I think it was 134 at the end of the day, in cities from red states and cities, Cody, Wyoming, to blue states like Vermont, and it really allowed them to look across that landscape and say, how can we create a common win, a common good, and move that forward? So again, it's looking at the opportunities that are out there and fitting your goals, your winnable milestones, your public goods into a broader landscape and have a more potent and powerful and broad base of support.
Yeah, those spatial maps can be great. You get to see things you never had seen before, and a lot of eureka moments do come out of that. The fourth question you pose is, are your messages aimed at winning new allies or just making your base feel good? And here, the language you use makes a big difference. Speak to this, Susan, and how groups can find that right language.
You know, a lot of us understand intuitively as people that language matters a lot. Names matter and words matter. So when we think about things like the word climate change, that already turns off a whole group of the electorate. It's very energizing to the base of people who are focused on those issues, but climate change is not a phrase that resonates across the spectrum. There are phrases that resonate with conservatives, with Republicans, things like freedom, you know, individual rights, liberty. And there are phrases that, you know, we know resonate with jobs agenda, you know, creating, you know, job creation, you know, competition, free mm-hmm. markets. There's a whole set of language. And then there's this commensurate set of language on the left. And so part of the question is, we did not in this article take a position on, you know, you should be a left-leaning advocate or you should be a right-leaning advocate. We just wanted to step back and say, what's happening? Let's understand what's happening.
What works?
What's working? What is being effective? So that whether you're on the left or the right, you can read this article and mm-hmm. say, this is either what my friends are doing or what my opposition is doing. Let's actually understand it a little bit more. So what's interesting is that the Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions really asked the question of how can they work with Republican policymakers on environmental issues. And so that could be a very politically divisive process, or it could be one where there's common ground to be found. And one of the questions that they were asking is things like, you know, there are messages, environmental messages that are deep, deep in the Republican and conservative movement. Things like being responsible stewards of God's creation. Mm-hmm. Things like creating new jobs and a stronger economy based on clean and renewable energy. Things like, you know, global competitiveness and that sort of thing. So there are really important core values to conservatives. And I think the question was, you know, are there ways to find that middle ground, find new messaging frameworks by deeply listening and to others on the other side of the aisle? And they had a pretty successful set of outcomes by doing it that way. I will say that philanthropists are sometimes their own worst enemy on this one because they want to fund programs. Mm-hmm. They want to fund a child and an after-school program. They want to save a tree. They want to save, you know, whatever it is, a whale. What they don't necessarily do is think to invest in polling or messaging because it has such a bad reputation of, well, obviously you're trying to influence me and skew things and, you know, there's just this propaganda element to it. And of course, that is a reality, so I don't want to be Pollyanna. But this messaging and polling is what values are you speaking to on the other side when it's at its best so that you can create that common ground and find sort of those common paths forward. And again, in an increasingly partisan and, you know, society, what does it look like to invest in that way? It's just it's a powerful question to ask.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the recommendations that I did like was bringing in polling firms from the other side to give you that different perspective. The fifth and final question is, are you using new technologies to educate and advocate? Tell us about that, and what are some of those new technologies?
So this is a fun one because every time when we wrote the article to now even, the technology has changed to listen and advocate. But these social listening technologies really do link to the polling conversation and really understanding, tracking conversations around different phrases, different words. There are ways to use their apps that you can do with very little money that incredible grassroots organizations are paying attention to. There's hashtag movements, there's tagging, word clouds, and what happens is that you can listen to how your issue is playing out in social media and find places, again, to find more advocates, to see what's resonating, and where you can share values. And again, for every one of these, you can use this for good or for evil. Mm-hmm. So I think our goal is that more people will be inspired to use all of this for good. But for sure, we know that, you know, that people are using these technologies in nefarious ways also. So I think part of the question is, what role can philanthropists play when there are these, you know, sort of less savory, you know, ways to that messaging is trying to be controlled? What are ways to elevate that dialogue, put a spotlight on it, and engage people in a different way to kind of get it back on track.
You know, you also note in your article that advocacy campaigns, much like everything else, they evolve and develop. And there are different stages where philanthropists can play a role. What are some of those different stages?
So it's an interesting question. Philanthropists sometimes want to jump into the fray. And we've seen a few very high-profile philanthropists willing to be on the front pages, the Koch brothers on the right, George Soros on the left. And folks like that have really, you know, taken a stand, and they are happy and willing to be a. I would say overwhelmingly, the philanthropists that we talk to are not interested in that sort of spotlight and that sort of role. But there are kind of interesting, unlikely pairs and opportunities that can be created, mostly because, again, as we just look out in the landscape right now, the plates, the tectonic plates are shifting, right? There are new alliances being formed, new old things that are falling into crevices, lots of disruption in the political sphere, in the business sphere. I mean, just think about the Me Too movement. Think about some of the primaries that we're seeing. There are so many places where the rules are getting disrupted. So in that situation, where can organizations that care deeply about engaging with communities, grassroots organizations, I mean, unions are using this very powerfully. How can you create new alliances and new approaches? So, for example, donors can say, well, where is our core issue? At the most basic level, where is our core issue? Even if we don't want to engage on it, we at least want to make sure that we are not getting, that we know who's on the other side, that we know where the opportunities are, even if we never fund a thing. But it might open up opportunities that people are interested in. So I think about some of the, you know, marijuana legislation, some of the nonviolent offenders legislation, some of the legislation around the opioid crisis, where there really are interesting cross-party lines that are, LGBT is another one, where there are cross-party coalitions that can get formed. And that's what's exciting, because not all of the trenches have been dug, and so with this disruption comes opportunity. So even at the most basic level, understanding the landscape that you're operating in, that your issue is operating in, the political map, the advocacy map, the public engagement map, political will, language, all these, you know, opposition, all these things that we talk about in the article, you've got to make sure you understand it. And then there's a question of, you know, how do you want to engage as a philanthropist, either publicly or privately, right? There really are other ways to engage that are not public to do that. And again, we've seen some of that both for good and for not so good. But that inaction, the failure to act, the failure to understand this is in and of itself inaction. So I think people are really starting to see that.
Well, finally, Susan, and picking up a little bit on what you just said, with the stakes being so high around so many issues at the moment, but the temperature is pretty high as well, do you anticipate an uptick in activity or maybe even a surge of philanthropists becoming involved in advocacy campaigns?
I do. I think that, you know, I start with the premise that philanthropy has a positive and important role to play in society, but it is not an absolute good. About 10 years ago, we wrote a piece in the Harvard Business Review called Galvanizing Philanthropy, where we talk about some of those hazards, right, of, you know, unlike businesses, there are no customers for philanthropy to be accountable to. Unlike government, there are no voters. You know, unlike the private sector, there are no investors, no shareholders. So legally, by design, philanthropists have wide latitude to engage in this way. And I think, though, that is not an unfettered good. We need those risks are real. At the same time, this latitude gives donors incredible freedom to experiment in ways that the government can't experiment. Think about these public parks, public art, public health clinics. We wrote a piece last year as well for the Harvard Business Review called Audacious Philanthropy, which was 15 success stories for how philanthropists can change the world, car seats and all these other things. But what it requires is, it can't be done the way it's always been done. I think people are looking at the landscape right now and saying, we need to change. Philanthropy at its worst is top down, it is tone deaf, it is personally driven, it's unresponsive to the community. All those things are true. But at its best, you know, philanthropists can work with the communities they want to benefit. They can, you know, flip that narrative and partner differently, help communities and help, you know, different constituencies achieve their full potential in the way that government alone can't do, and that, you know, the corporate world alone can't do. So I think the real question is, in this moment, what is the highest and best use of the role that flexible philanthropy can play, mindful of all of the pitfalls and the, you know, the complexities, in order to sort of rebuild our, you know, our democracy. Mm-hmm. And I'll just end with a line from Darren Walker, who is the incredibly thoughtful, visionary head of the Ford Foundation. And, you know, he sort of, his words from probably a year ago resonate with me, which is that, you know, at the core of our democracy is hope. And our greatest threat is not terrorism or an outside, you know, pandemic. It's hopelessness, because when society becomes hopeless, people do desperate things. Mm-hmm. And so how can philanthropy at its best help build a strong civil society? And how can philanthropy's role in advocacy with government be used for that good? And I do think that we all have a role in that conversation.
A good question to leave us with. Well, Susan Wolf-Dickhoff, a partner at the Bridge Grand Group and the co-head of their philanthropy practice, I want to thank you for being here this evening. The article, again, is When Philanthropy Meets Advocacy. You can find it on the Stanford Social Innovation Review website. And there's also a link to it on bridgeband.org. It was a pleasure to have you on the show, Susan.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.